Welcome to the Mad Tech Podcast from ExchangeWire, bringing you the latest news and views from the world of ad tech, media, and marketing.
Hello and welcome back to the Mad Tech Podcast. I'm Amy Newell-Tarian, editor at ExchangeWire, and I'm here today with our COO, Lindsay Rowntree. How are you, Lindsay?
I'm very good, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Good to have you here.
Good to be here.
Yeah, and our special guest today is Nicole Prose, freelance presenter and educator for U of Digital. How's your week going, Nicole?
Great, really happy to be here.
Good to have you. So today we're covering stories about Meta serving 4Gen and ads, a podcasting push from TikTok and Netflix, plus transparency in CTV advertising. So starting with Meta, who's been profiting from 4Gen and advertising on its platforms. Documents seen by Reuters show Meta's predictions that 10% of its 2024 revenue would come from running ads from scams and banned goods. One document reveals that its platforms show users an estimated 15 billion higher risk scam advertisements, meaning those that show clear signs of being fraudulent every single day. So annually, Meta earns about $7 billion in revenue from this category of scam ads. And currently, it only bans ads when its automated systems are at least 95% certain that a marketer is committing fraud. So, Nicole, how worrying are these revelations? What do you think?
So I think they're worrying, but the thing that stands out to me right away is that we're looking at numbers and not percentages. So $7 billion sounds staggering, but that's because of Meta's scale. Like, they're on track to make something like $200 billion out of advertising this year. So we're talking about 3 to 4% of their, you know, total earnings this year going towards these fraudulent ads. And I think that, you know, for me, yes, absolutely, Meta is wholly responsible for all of the scams that they allow to perpetrate. But part of their larger business is, you know, this is a minimal part of it. So I think that I'm not sure that this is the sword I'd die on in terms of the ills of social media, but I think that it's something that definitely could be handled better.
Yeah. Lindsay, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think I totally agree with Nicole that you know, we're talking sort of 3 to 4% of that, 10% of the total ads being served. It's something like 15 billion ads a day. Yeah. But as a percentage, again, it's still quite a small percentage.
Yeah. And they don't even say how many ads per day they serve to users. No, so we don't even know what 15 billion represents.
You're completely making huge assumptions.
Exactly.
Right?
The numbers look good in media.
Yeah, exactly. I think what's interesting is, and what I'm keen to get your thoughts on, is does the fact that they are able to even make that estimate mean that there is something they can do about it? Like, if they know they're serving ads that are that a percentage of ads are fraudulent and a percentage of their revenue is coming from fraudulent advertising, does that then not mean they have control over it?
I mean, I think they do to a degree. Remember, a lot of this is automated and being measured at scale through programmatic devices and signals, et cetera. And so you mentioned 95% certainty. Yes, that's really high. But like, who have you? I mean, I've known, for example, a number of people who have their legitimate Facebook accounts closed and banned and locked down because, you know, they were mistakenly fraudulent, and then they can't even get them back because there's no infrastructure in place for them to raise that to Facebook. So if you imagine that they're at 95% and you know somebody who already has been impacted by this, maybe a small business, maybe a person, maybe, you know, whatever, that where it's been incorrect, then, you know, if you drop that threshold down to, say, 80%, then what kind of legitimate business are you starting to lose, right? So it's a really, you know, it's a tough sort of grayscale to sort of measure upon, because you don't want, say, a small mom and pop business that maybe isn't very savvy, who does have kind of janky looking ads, but is a legitimate business, being blocked. And then, of course, having no recourse to action because there is no way to get in touch with Meta.
Yeah.
And the other thing to think about from my perspective is this is across multiple different platforms. I mean, this is, I tend to conflate Meta and Facebook still.
Yeah, exactly the same. You see Meta, you assume, oh, Facebook being fraudulent again.
Exactly.
And that's not the case.
Exactly. Yeah. But also, you know, there's WhatsApp, there's Instagram. Mm. You know, they have their other platforms. So it's really hard to understand where the root of this, you know, 15% is coming from. Can they do better? Absolutely. Can they block it more efficiently? Unclear. But for me, they could do better in terms of providing user support and education.
Yeah, that is a really good point. Because I think as well, like, one of the things that the concern that you have when you see this kind of information come through is that it's very much part of Meta's business model. And not just Meta, any publicly traded tech company that operates this way, they're trying to get revenue. And it's always a drive for revenue, always a drive to keep shareholders happy. Yes. And that's how these businesses are run. And I think that there was when the whistleblower Frances Haugen, when she came out with kind of all the different things she had against Meta during her time there, one of the things was that ties into this quite well was it's not like a mistake, it's part of their business model.
Yeah.
Like when they cut staff members, they're often cut from places like security and privacy.
Absolutely.
And that then means that this job gets harder.
Yes.
And that this kind of 5% that they're kind of missing out on could well have been maybe an even lower percentage if they hadn't got rid of those people in the first place. And that's where you then start to ask more questions.
Absolutely. And I completely agree with that. And I think, you know, technology will, first of all, being able to detect this through patterns and, you know, natural language processing and all of that, that will improve the precision. But I think it still comes back to, you know, exactly what you're saying, cutting staff. So then how do you manage this through a human perspective? Also, some of these, you know, banned goods and other unsavory things that are being advertised are kind of traumatizing to the people who have to look at it. So this isn't just an easy thing where it's like, well, this is part of their business model, but there must have been a calculated decision in terms of what that threshold that they are willing to sacrifice in terms of revenue as well as preserve for their advertisers. But, you know, again, to my point, like, is this the sword we're going to die on? I mean, if I was going to go after Facebook, I would start thinking about like the impact on young people and about reasons. You know, body dysmorphia, suicide, all kinds of stuff. And then that's not just Facebook, that's TikTok, that's you know, YouTube, that's all the things. And it's a genre. Very imperfect system. And to your point, every single one of them has it incorporated into their business model.
Exactly. And I wonder, because obviously the numbers they've put out are quite sensational, and so it makes you wonder kind of when an advertiser sees that, will they go, well, hang on a second, I'm paying a lot of money to advertise to what I think legitimate people, and it turns out I might not be, and there are marketers out there that are scamming, and there are users out there that are being scammed. Will advertisers kind of go, well, I'm out, I'm not going to invest in them, because Meta have told me as a walled garden they are safe and secure. It turns out that the walled garden business model is actually kind of more for their benefit and their ability to control data and pricing than it is for them to provide me a secure environment to advertise to a number of users. Is an advertiser going to then go, I'm not going to, because also is the opportunity cost right? When an advertiser kind of goes, well, I invest quite a lot in Meta across Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, whatever, it's easy, because it's easy. It's easy for me to buy. Yeah. It's very, very easy to me to
and
buy.
And scale.
Scale, exactly. So am I going to see that and go, oh, well, it is easy to buy, so am I going to...
No one's going to drop out.
No.
I mean, this is not going to be where they decide to drop out of Facebook. But I think also, you know, this is the type of article and presentation of data that makes advertisers get worried. And, you know, again, so I spent a number of years running supply quality brand safety at Criteo, and it's a little bit of a, you know, parallel kind of issue, which is, you know, somebody runs an ad in the wrong place and, you know, maybe it's three impressions, but somebody saw those three impressions. And so they say, you know, this advertiser is running on child porn. And it's like, where in the depths of the internet, first of all, what are we doing on child porn? But second of all, where in the depths of the internet did you find this, and how many impressions was it? So, know, there is just this, I think there's definitely the opportunity to do better. And I certainly think Facebook needs to do better. Sorry, Meta needs to do better. No, sorry, the industry needs to do better. Let me get that straight. No, the industry needs to do better. And, you know, I think a lot of it comes back to my original point, which is like, you know, the protections that they provide to victims is especially important. I mean, take the $7 billion and invest it in, you know, in initiatives to help the victims of these crimes.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So, I mean, it's a penny, right? It's 3%.
It's nothing. It's fine.
It's a call it an operating cost.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Cost of doing business.
Exactly.
Yeah, completely.
Exactly. So,
do you think Meta should face any consequences then for these fraudulent ads or not really?
I mean, again, we are looking at leaked information that was given to Reuters. We don't know what the full documentation says. We don't know the timeline. We don't know who presented or crafted this information. We don't know where the data came from. We just know that in some leaked documents that this was positioned in a way whereby Meta was deliberately being allowing these fraudulent ads in favor of revenue, right? I think that it deserves an investigation. I think that if this is a practice that, you know, continues or isn't trying to be improved or something like that, then yes, absolutely, they should face consequences. But I think we're just looking at this, and I don't think that we're just looking at this now, and I don't think that it's been investigated to a point where we can say what those remedies should be at this point or what those consequences should be. And I think that once that is identified, if it continues to be a willfully malicious pattern, then absolutely there should be consequences. But that doesn't just go for Meta. That goes for anyone in the industry.
Yeah, all the big platforms.
Yeah. I think it's good to have Nicole bring her perspective, because you've worked on that side of it for so long. You can kind of go, yeah, okay, this is a big deal, but it's always been a big deal. It's always been going on. We had to have some perspective.
Exactly. Yeah. And I, you know, it's not to excuse the behavior. It's not to condone the behavior, but it's to put it in perspective. Yeah. You know, I mean, there are so many things on the internet that scare the heck out of me. This is probably the least of it.
Wow.
I mean, I mean, seriously, like that's how kind of percentage-wise and consequential this is, you know. I'm much more worried about something like a dating platform where real life, you know, the fact that they can't get rid of predators on dating platforms and the lack of safety in real life that that can bring. I mean, and yes, I know that some of these scams and ads on Facebook lead to similar results, but what's up? I keep doing the conflation of Meta and Facebook. But I just, you know, I think that this is scary. I think that it's inappropriate, but it's not the biggest issue that we have with the digital environment today.
Yeah, definitely. And Keith, my marketing team, had a sneezing fit during that, so I don't think much for that. But bless you, Keith. I hope you're okay there.
Smile, you're on candid camera.
Yeah, smile, you're not on the camera. I'm just calling out your sneezing fit.
I actually didn't hear that.
You're not.
I didn't either. I could just see
Keith in the background getting redder and redder, and I was like, "Is he all right about that?"
Yeah, actually, you can really miss that. That's so funny.
I'm probably listening to the sound
of the
voice, but
right. So, moving on to our second story now, and changing direction to look at what's been going on in the podcasting landscape. So TikTok and iHeartMedia have teamed up to create the TikTok Podcast Network, an initiative which will feature podcasts from TikTok creators. The companies also announced TikTok Radio, a station blending creator-hosted segments with trending music and behind-the-scenes stories. The partnership aims to attract sponsorships and new revenue streams. Meanwhile, there's been reports that Netflix is planning to produce original video podcasts exclusive to its own platform, signaling a deeper push into the podcast market. Sources have said that the company has approached creators to develop new shows, and Netflix also intends to change the design of its mobile app to make podcasts easier to discover. So, Lindsay, what can we deduce from this push from both these giants into podcasting?
I feel like there's two different directions they're coming from. So I think the TikTok direction is almost, TikTok and iHeartMedia partnering is almost like creating a flywheel. And basically, we've got all of these creators, let's put them to good use in a genre that we know is just like going gangbusters. How can we work to bring a different type of format to TikTok? And I feel like being able to do that, and then the beauty of kind of video recorded podcasts, which is an area that I'm still kind of getting to grips with. Obviously, we are now recording this podcast or video as well, but I still only listen to them audio.
Well, this is my question. Yeah. It's like, how do we, I mean, what is a video podcast?
How
is that different from short form media platform?
I listen to a lot of podcasts that are like always on podcasts, the kind of weekly recorded things, and they're clearly doing things for the benefit of the people watching. I'm like, well, how many people are watching your podcast versus listening to it? Because I'm an avid listener. I'll probably never watch an episode, 100%. But all the stuff you're doing is like, it's silence to me. And you're kind of going, and they're going, which is great for audio. I'm thinking, yes, it's not. We're not great for audio. You're absolutely right. Like, what's happening?
Yeah,
it's driving
absolutely.
Me mad.
There's a particular podcast that I love listening to. And every time that they're basically interviewing other people and they're showing them things.
Yeah.
And they're like, can you describe what you're looking at? And I'm like, no, that doesn't help me.
No.
I'm like, just skip that part.
Just don't do it.
Exactly.
Don't do it.
And so I think that, you know, from from the perspective of what is a video podcast, I mean, where do you draw the line?
Yeah.
Because it's not a podcast. Exactly. Yeah.
So there's a definition issue here, clearly. Yeah,
definitely.
And I think the TikTok iHeartMedia thing makes that even more complicated and convoluted because it's like, what will a TikTok podcast even look like, especially if it's going to be video and clipped up and kind of in the short form, kind of bringing short form and long form together. And then the Netflix side of things, it feels like they are maybe worried about YouTube and maybe worried about how well YouTube are doing, especially if everyone's now recording their podcasts and publishing them on YouTube. Mm-hmm. Netflix are like, we need to get in on this game as well and understand what that looks like. And I think if you look at China, so Duyen and a name I'm going to butcher again and Dane is going to make faces, is I think it's called something Mara. Zimalaya. No, she's.
I don't know, but this is
she's shaking her head at me. Yeah, we'll never know. Zimalaya, maybe, and Duyen, who are the Chinese version of TikTok. They've been doing this for a long time, so they've already gone down the route of trying to bring podcasts into their platforms and be able to click them up and kind of get their creators creating podcasts. So actually, once again, we're quite far behind in the development of this versus what's happening over in China and kind of in the East world generally. So that's going to be an interesting thing to look at. And the other thing that I'm interested in is that what are Spotify going to do in all this?
Yeah.
And that's where I find, and actually, to be fair, Amazon as well, because Amazon have invested a lot in kind of deals with certain podcast creators.
Well, they bought Wondery.
They bought, exactly. And that is also the interesting thing is that what... Because Netflix getting involved with this makes me interested in that. Obviously, Netflix have done quite a lot of, there's been a lot of like serial podcasts.
Yeah.
Like Serial, but not Serial. Yeah. Serial podcasts that Netflix have then eventually turned into dramatized series and that have been really good and really popular.
Agreed.
Will Netflix try and create the beginning of that journey? So actually we'll own the podcast series that we can then turn into a video series as well after that, or just do the whole thing, like an investigation or a dramatization, which they did with like Dirty John and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But what they will be doing kind of goes against the trend that I'm seeing in podcasts. I thought I was reading about in podcasts, and I don't know where I heard this or read this, but actually the Always On podcast is far more popular than the series. And so Wondery being bought by Amazon are kind of like, I think they're writing a lot of that down, aren't they? Because they're saying that actually it's not really working out for them because the series isn't really as popular as the Always On anymore. And they're not really sure what the... I said, Nicole's shaking her head, so I'm not really sure.
I mean, I don't know the answer to that.
That's for our audio listeners. Nicole is shaking her head.
Yeah. For our audio listeners. Yeah. No, I mean, I'm not sure if that's a way... I'm not sure if Wondery isn't working because of the way that Amazon executed that and the integration with Amazon Music and keeping it as a standalone or whatever.
Yeah, weird.
So
confusing.
I'm not clear where the not working is because, I mean, as far as I can tell, Wondery does still have a quite big following and produces some of the top podcasts.
That's true, it does. They are very good podcasts.
So, yeah, it's hard to say, but I like your point about, like, Dirty John and the whole, you said it in the beginning, flywheel.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I think, to me, this is just an indication that having authenticated logged-in users across multiple different screens and platforms is the future, right? So the if you're not a Netflix watcher, maybe you're going to go ahead and sign into the Netflix podcast and then you still have that logged in experience and you still your database of user data grows.
That's it. The data is interesting here, isn't it?
And then TikTok, I don't know. I mean, I don't mean to be conspiratorial, but I'm wondering if their partnership with iHeartData, one, it's good for iHeartData.
Heart data. But you do heart data.
I do heart data. Yes.
Yeah, we all heart data. Yeah.
But their partnership with iHeart, they basically get to anchor their data in a company that's not being investigated by the US government. I don't know. Just saying.
Oh, I love that. Yeah.
You know, don't want to get any conspiracy theories going, but it's interesting, right? Like, I mean, TikTok obviously has a younger generation. I mean, I'm sure there's something three generations for me that I don't know about that's better than TikTok. But TikTok has a huge audience. iHeart needs to expand their audience and basically to continue to grow and survive. And it seems like a very logical place for them to come together.
It does.
And the shared data is going to be fantastic.
Yeah. It does, because you wonder, without these partnerships, how else will radio and podcasting grow? Like, what is the next phase of it? So this does make sense, but it does then mean there's going to be a lot of blurred lines. And I'm intrigued. And also, because podcast measurement, the measurement is an attribution, is really challenging.
Yeah.
And so again, bringing the other side of it into this, will it actually can bring in the two data sources together? Will that make measurement attribution much easier as well?
Yeah. And again, especially on platforms that are authenticated users, right? Mm. right? So I think it, you know, and it gets a little gray in terms of where consent happens. So, you know, again, back to TikTok.
Oh, yeah, like, yeah, that's very true.
You know, yeah. If you consent through iHeart, is that better than consenting through TikTok if something happens? I don't know. I mean, like, who knows, right? But it gets gray. Like, who owns the data? Who, you know, especially when we're in Europe, I mean, these kind of things are happening in the US. I don't even want to know how they're going to deal with their European users. But no. But no, I think it's, you know, it's a data play. It's a cross-platform play. It's, you know, a measurement play, all of those things that basically help build scale across multiple different platforms and particularly screens.
Mm. And I also wonder as well what that then means for YouTube.
Yeah.
Because that just, like, I think YouTube is the big kind of elephant in the room that everyone just doesn't know how to handle it. Everyone, yeah. No one knows what to do and how to compete against YouTube.
Absolutely. And it's the default, might be right? A way, like, you watch it on YouTube.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think it's absolutely, particularly the Netflix piece, is like, clearly, you know, that's where they're angling for. It's yeah. That same kind of short form video that is, you know, influencers and, you know, kind of validated users that are creating UGC, but video.
Mm.
So, yeah, no, I think YouTube is exactly it. Mm. It's exactly it. And there's some crazy stat about, like, all TV in general, like, is some enormous percentage of all TV in general is consumed through YouTube. So how do you compete with that?
Exactly. And again, like, YouTube has long been blurring the lines of kind of what is video versus what is TV. And now kind of everyone trying to understand what YouTube is making them now blur the lines with other channels too, kind of blur the lines of audio and visual and audiovisual. And it's just making it very complicated. And it's going to be a buyer's nightmare.
Because
ultimately the buyer just wants to get to the consumer and they want to understand how to get to them. And I think that when you're looking at channel-based buys,
yes,
that makes this more complicated and will make an advertiser have to rethink how they are targeting people.
Yes. In my paper notes here, I wrote that, you know, the outcome I would expect are more hedged gardens and consolidated fragmentation.
Yeah, I totally
You know,
agree.
It's like
yeah.
The more you consolidate and the more that you offer reach across multiple different platforms, the more that you become fragmented in the way that you have to buy, because you can't just have, you know, you can't just have YouTube. You have to have YouTube and Netflix and Amazon. But it's a, you know, amalgamation of hedged gardens,
yes,
rather than, you know, independent sites.
Yeah, definitely.
So, yeah, it's interesting. But I mean, it's also extremely reflective of how we as humans consume content for the most part these days. So, yeah.
It is.
But I'm with you on the audio podcast.
Yeah.
But podcast is audio.
Are we just a part of a generation that's just like, and the young folk are all watching everything on video?
Probably. I have
them very separate in my head. Like, my podcast is for my kind of like walking time or like my driving time,
exactly,
or whatever. And then everything, I'm never going to watch a video when I could watch a TV show.
Yeah.
So I don't understand. But to me, everything's quite separate. Whereas the generation below me and for the Zoomers,
yes,
everything is one. So it doesn't make a difference, does it?
I agree. Actually, one of my biggest frustrations is that if I want to listen to something on YouTube but not watch the video and just have it in my pocket, you can't.
Like, no,
okay, yeah,
no.
So
that's really annoying. Yeah, I do agree with that.
Yeah, that is annoying.
Maybe listen
like
that.
Yeah, I do listen to some podcasts now actually with video.
Do you?
Although I prefer, I guess it depends where I am. If I'm out somewhere, obviously I would, you know, while I'm walking or something, I would obviously just listen to the audio. But then if I was at home, maybe, and I was eating something, I would maybe put on the video to watch something while I'm eating.
I agree, so, because I don't just sit at home and listen to podcasts. Like, if I'm at home and I need background distraction, it does tend to be video.
Yeah.
But again, it's just, it's about reach. It's about getting as many eyeballs and ears.
Yeah. It used to be eyeballs or ears. And now it's eyeballs and ears in one go.
That's right.
Everything. Yeah.
Something like, for everyone.
It is. And like, you know, advertising perspective, I was listening to a podcast yesterday and I heard two specific brands. One was the shoe store. Mm-hmm. And the other was, crap, what was it? Can't remember. Oh, the Singleton whiskey, which I keep hearing on podcasts. So I heard those ads and I was watching something on, it would have been on a streaming platform, probably Netflix, because I pay to have the ads because I'm cheap. And again, I saw those two ads in CTV. So it felt like they're two progressive brands that are investing heavily in podcast or in audio advertising, but also in streaming advertising. And it's interesting to see that what kind of brands are coming through and what I'm seeing in those platforms versus what I might see advertising on linear TV.
Yeah.
I wouldn't see those brands on linear TV, but I would see them on streaming platforms.
Were they accurate? Did you buy new shoes and some whiskey?
I did not buy either of those things. No.
Well,
but I keep getting targeted by them. So, yeah.
But I think also, like, you know, if you think about it, like, podcast advertising is terrible.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
Yeah.
Mm, it's like considering how much, you know, and I'm, you know, I'm cheap too. So like I don't pay for Spotify. I have the ad supported. I mean, it is absolutely shockingly bad. Mm. So, you know, again, this is an opportunity to identify users better. And then of course with, let's just say it because we haven't said AI yet, but with AI and agentic buying, there could be, you know, much more opportunity to reach multi-platform, you know, formats in at scale.
That is so true. That's where this comes together. And that's where that makes this crossover much easier will be the agentic side of things. Yeah, that's such a good point.
So we'll see. But I'm with you. Audio for podcasts.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to start a campaign.
I think I'll join you on that campaign. Yeah, I'll be front and center with you, Nicole. 100%.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of opportunities for advertisers. Really.
Yeah, they really definitely are. Yeah, it opens a whole new world for them.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, and then just going back, and we were talking about obviously like the biggest platforms. Do you think we could see similar moves from other big platforms like Meta, for example, Meta's platforms? Yeah. Do you think we'll see them try to get into podcasting? Or
I mean,
because I guess now it is so tied to video. Yeah. It would be easy for them to do it.
If they do, they'll just copy it. They'll copy what TikTok did because they did with Reels.
100%. Yeah, they can also, you know, it's not, they already have the creators. It wouldn't be a huge leap to basically spin off an audio app.
Yeah.
Or something.
No.
Or partner with somebody. You know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Exactly, because TikTok and Instagram, in the context of Meta, have distinct creators. Some create just for Instagram, some create just for TikTok. There is obviously many crossovers as well, but I think that it could work really well for Instagram and Meta to get involved with whatever we're defining a podcast as.
Yeah, well, and I think that this just basically eliminates the need for a definition. It's like find your users where they're at.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, Instagram aren't going to want to miss out. Meta aren't going to want to miss out on that.
Yeah,
definitely not.
They'll see where the trends are going. And they want to be involved.
Yeah, absolutely. They're always copying the trends. So.
Yeah, exactly. They will wait for others to go first, fail, and then they'll go, right, we'll just copy that version.
Second mover advantage.
Bish, bash, bosh. Definitely. Done. Yeah.
And yeah, with podcasting and video now so linked, they'll definitely be doing that probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's move on to the third story now. An opinion piece on Exchange Wire by Clem Birdsall, sales director at Publica by IAS, examines transparency in CTV advertising with a focus on what buyers are currently asking for. He concludes that for buyers, better outcomes are built on a foundation of transparency and that this presents both a challenge and an opportunity for publishers. The challenge is that it requires investment in ad serving and data infrastructure that can capture and share this level of detail. And the opportunity is that by meeting buyer expectations, publishers can differentiate themselves and build deeper relationships with agencies and brands. So, Nicole, how important is transparency and why?
I think the thing is that, again, when we look at these type of stories, and, you know, there was some quote about advertisers that told us that performance is it, right? So we need the transparency to be able to improve the performance. But the thing is which advertisers, right? I mean, so is it a global brand? Probably. Is it a regional brand? Almost certainly. Is it a local mom and pop shop? Probably not. Mm. And so I think there's a level of transparency that's always important, right? You need to make sure that, you know, you get what you pay for, number one. And number two, that, you know, your brand integrity is intact, and so that you can actually, you know, you don't want to be potentially on unsafe or illegal sites. But, you know, there's a reason why PMax does well, right? Because it's set and forget, and they're getting the performance that they want, and their level of brand identity, if they're a smaller advertiser, is not going to be as precious as a global or regional advertiser. So I think, you know, again, as in terms of a grayscale, transparency is a grayscale. What does it mean? And actually, in the article, they go through various different types of transparency. And I think that, you know, it depends on the advertiser. But I think, again, you need to understand what your advertisers want. And when they say that performance is the be all and end all, I can guarantee you that is not true. Because the minute that their ad shows up somewhere that they don't want, if it's performing all day long, they're not going to be happy. So know what kind of transparency they need, and also make sure that the advertisers understand the balance between you know, performance and brand safety, brand suitability, or whatever it is that they are looking at in terms of, you know, full transparency.
Yeah.
And I think one more thing on that point is that what are they going to do with that data? Like, do they have the internal staff or tools to be able to ingest large levels of transparency data and actually execute and activate on the exact things that would make the performance be improved?
Yeah, Lindsay, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with Nicole. I think that not related to CTV specifically, but just more generally, transparency in our industry kind of goes through, like, it ebbs and flows. And it depends as well what's happening in the industry, kind of what transparency reports come out that make an advertiser kind of go, what? Okay, we need to double down transparency. And they might do that for a few months, and then they get kind of tired of it because they go through
Q4 when they have to
see. Absolutely, like, well, actually, we've got quite a lot going on at the moment. They might go to their agency and ask for all their log files, and then the agency will go, sure, I can give you a log files, sure, but you know, do you know what they are? Like, what are you going to do with them? And they'll be given these log files and go, I don't know what this is. Like, as you said, like, they haven't got the resource, they haven't got the intelligence, like, not intelligence, but the understanding of what they actually are and how they work and how to actually kind of get any meaningful data out of them, insight out of them. And I think it's interesting in the article that Clem wrote, kind of what the sort of questions that they get when it comes to CTV specifically, kind of what content do my ads run on? Who else is in the pod of the ads that my brand appeared on? And, you know, they're all relevant things that when you're buying from linear TV, you have more control over. And it sounds like these advertisers probably have previously bought from, again, related to you saying, are they a global advertiser? Most likely. Are they a regional advertiser? Most likely. Kind of, are they a mom and pop shop? Probably not. They will probably have experience buying linear, in which case they have more control over kind of where the ads are seen and kind of what's appearing when and et cetera. And then with CTV, that control is lost. And there's, what is control versus what is transparency? There is a blurring of lines, but if you look at a Venn diagram, there's a difference between control and transparency. One is, I want to be able to do exactly what this is and CTV doesn't really allow that. It's like CTV is, you know, if your comment about PMAX kind of ties in really well with set and forget, there needs to be an element of that with CTV because you cannot control exactly where your ad appears, certainly who it appears around. Like, you obviously never want to have your ad appear to a competitor, and there are guardrails against that, but it is not quite as controllable as a linear TV buy is, certainly in this country, but especially kind of, you know, you're trying to buy kind of the 7 p.m. slot with during X Factor or whatever. It used to be the kind of the age old, this is the holy grail of what an ad slot looks like. And you be able to buy like the entire ad break and have all, as an agency, have all your brands appear in one ad break. That this is a very, very different way of doing it. And I think that the questions relate to somebody who clearly had that control as a linear buyer and now wants to have the same control as a CTV buyer.
Absolutely.
And is struggling.
I mean, it's like where we were 25 years ago when, you know, display advertising first came out, right? So, you know, back in the day, I did ad operations for MTV. And like when we would have the VMA awards, we had very specific sections of the site that were sponsored by. And, you know, if we had Coke sponsoring, you know, the VMAs, then we absolutely didn't have Pepsi ads running in the VMA section and usually not on the site at all during that time. With programmatic, the tools to be able to execute those same type of controls and displays took a long time to be developed. And we're kind of in a place now where that works to a relatively good degree in programmatic display. But exactly what you said, we're coming from a linear to a programmatic world in television or video or CTV, whatever it is, and another thing that is so loosely defined right now, but you know, any kind of screen. And the benefit of moving away from the linear approach is, absolutely, we're not doing the 7 p.m. slot. We're going to find your best user at the right time in the right place and present it to them on an individual basis. And so, you know, that is absolutely the upside and the benefit, but we need the tools to be able to make sure that all those other things like adjacency and, you know, specific time slots or specific content are respected.
Yeah. I think that ties in nicely with kind of, you know, your earlier comment as well, like, what does transparency mean? Like, again, it's a question of definitions again, isn't it? Like, what is an advertiser actually asking for? And I feel like if you're advertising investing in CTV where you have also invested in linear or used to and are switching or kind of shifting budget from one to the other, versus if you're a digitally native brand who has only invested in CTV and never invested in linear, the questions you have are going to be different, and also how you define transparency will be completely different, because you're not going to be expecting that same level of control. You're going to want it in certain areas, but you'll want it based based on how you know programmatic to work.
Yeah.
And versus how you know kind of more linear channels to work.
And I think one of the interesting things that's happening as we make this transition, I can't remember if it was Mountain or MTN, whatever they're called, but one of the CTV platforms recently kind of made the push to go after the long tail. And it's like, you know, Bob's Mattress Shop in Omaha is not going to be advertising on, you know, CTV right now. But if there was something that was a little bit more set and forget, you know, you're talking to your hyper local audience.
Definitely.
So, you know, I think that there is opportunity to do a little bit of a set and forget approach, but then that's not going to work for the global advertisers. So, you know, transparency is a sliding scale.
Mm.
Yeah. So how hard is it at the moment for publishers to meet buyer expectations?
I mean, is it at the moment or since advertising began, right? Like, how far back should we go on this one? I mean, I do think there's particular challenges these days, and they're not necessarily just around the advertiser expectations. There's just a general downward pressure on publishers overall, right? So, I mean, you know, they have their content being lifted. They're competing with AI. You know, people want cheap media, but they don't want to pay for it. There's so many problems that publishers are facing that can lead to not meeting the advertisers' or buyers' expectations. But I think that one of the things that has come from programmatic as well is that you get a brief, or you don't even get a brief, right? We used to get a brief and it was like, this is what the buyer expects. You don't really even get that now. I mean, and moving even further away from that, right? So there's this expectation that you're going to meet my expectations, but I haven't really told you what they are. And mm-hmm. So with the kind of light human touch and human intervention, there is more room for miscommunication between the expectation that's set at the brand level that gets then passed down to the agency level, that then gets passed down to the trading desk level, that then gets executed into a, you know, digital insertion order and trafficked out onto a site. So I think that's one challenge. And I think, you know, another challenge is that publishers are really trying to figure out how to promote the value in their content and get people to pay the price for that. And if, you know, if performance is all you're interested in, if that's really the answer, then publishers don't have a chance, right? Because, you know, quality media doesn't necessarily mean performance, but high performing media can be curated through better tools and transparency, but through better tools that the publishers may have. Then it's always, it comes back to the, why is this on the publishers again to, you know, sort of prove the value of their media, invest in the ad tech stack. But I have a soft spot and I feel very badly for publishers because they get the brunt of it all the time. And I truly believe that good media is still worthwhile.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Lindsay, what do you think?
Yeah, I totally agree. I think the publishers, as is often the case, kind of, as you said, bear the brunt of it. And, you know, there's arguably there's a kind of bootstrapping issue here. And certainly in the US, where you're seeing so much consolidation among publishers, like if a buyer needs that level of transparency and that level of arguably control, and that's being passed down the chain through the agency, through the trading desk, everything else, down to the publisher, there aren't that many publishers that have the scale and the investment to be able to invest in that level of infrastructure that would allow them to meet the needs and demands of the buyer. So you've got two things. Either the publisher pushes back, which, depending on kind of how demand's looking for that certain channel, for the advertiser, whatever, the publisher pushing back could mean the advertiser will go, well, fine, I won't invest in you then. Or the publisher has to do what it can to meet the needs of the buyer, which means investing more and more money, which is going to cause more and more problems. And it means that the publisher could then fail. So you're seeing this consolidation happening, where actually the consolidation, you know, could arguably, and I rarely say this, could be a good thing, because it means that they can actually meet the needs of the buyers and actually give them what they want. And it means that smaller publishers, if they don't get bought by a larger one, they're going to have to bow out because they can't deliver on what is required, or they can only deliver to the mom and pop shops that won't have that kind of the level of control needed, and they will arguably be able to live in a kind of more set and forget it world.
Yeah. And I mean, I think there are some interesting initiatives as well. Like, there's collectives like Ozone and trying to help the publishers sort of, in a regulated fashion, make a better use of their inventory through scale. Mm. But it's difficult. Like, I do, everything you said is true. Like, it's really difficult for publishers to invest in these ever-changing trends so that they can continue to sort of meet the expectations of advertisers.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, there's always conversation around kind of trying to bring the publisher and the buyer closer together, allow them to have a more direct relationship. You could argue that that also has a benefit in the sense of it allows the publisher to go to the buyer and say, listen, this is what we're working against. Whereas if the publisher and the buyer are kind of, the buyer's kind of generally doing it anonymously and there's kind of far removed from everything, it then means that they are never having to understand the plight of the publisher because they're just going, this is what I want. The agency will then go, okay, well, we'll do what we can to try and get it. And then they'll go to the trading desk and go, yeah, okay, we'll do what we can. And the publisher's just left kind of going, well, what about me in all of this? Whereas if there is a, you know, in kind of the supply path optimization perspective, if there is a close relationship between them, it allows a publisher to fight their corner a bit and say, listen, this is how we're operating and this is what allows us to survive, and you're making that more difficult for us.
And, you know, again, not that I think that AI and agentic trafficking is the panacea, or even, I mean, who knows how it's going to develop and execute, but in the sort of fantastical world where all these wonderful agents that are intelligent and based on, you know, historical data and, you know, language, large language models, etc., maybe that conversation can be executed on behalf of the two parties a little bit easier, right? So part of that is, you know, every campaign, if you can, you know, instruct a agent in natural language based on the actual desires of the advertiser, that can get translated better into what the publisher is able to offer in response to that.
So, that's a good point.
I mean, you know, let's see.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely, yeah.
Dream case.
Yeah. So many dreams.
I know. So many years. Yeah. So many
dreams. Well, let's wrap up there. Thanks so much, Nicole, for joining us. It's
great
to have
you. Thank you very much for having me.
And lots of great insights.
Thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure and really fun talking to you guys.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, we'll have to have you back.
Definitely.
Thank you, Lindsay.
Thank you. It's been great.
Yeah, and thanks to all our listeners. Tune in next week.
You've been listening to the MadTech Podcast, brought to you by ExchangeWire.